Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am the net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. We're here every Sunday night at 8 p.m. We go on to about 11 p.m., and hopefully we inform and entertain a bunch of people listening in who will participate along with us and make this a interesting educational experience. Let me drop for a second, and I'll give you the usual links. As I often mention, if you can't reach us via the radio, you can reach us via email. You can either suggest a mailbag question that we will discuss while you listen, or you can suggest a topic of interest that we can discuss, or we enjoy puzzles. I have a very nice puzzle, I hope, for tonight, if we have the time. It's roughly about the ISS, but it takes other things into consideration. So I'm hoping that Paul enjoys it as well as other people, but we'll get to that. Or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and have him take a look at some kind of space-related or NASA-related article or YouTube and such and comment on it. You can reach me via the email address mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. I offer a series of interesting links every week. It's a new group. I leave the old group there so that you can pull it at your leisure. Some of it is just interesting articles that don't really work too well on a radio. They're a visual thing, or they're space-related, and I don't want to go into Paul's SpaceNet report topics. Oh, and the bottom list is a bunch of general science topics that I can discuss during the science talk segment if we have it, if we have time for it. So please avail yourself of that link page at your leisure. It'll remain there for the foreseeable future. Just type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to my link page. In addition, a chat room is open and available. You can either go to Limark's own website and look for the link and click that, or you can type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to our chat room. And I try to stream this on the Internet. The W2VL Glen Oaks repeater feed through the Internet. You just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to that. And as always, I like to remind people that Mike, KC2NJI, has a fantastic archive site of many of the amateur radio, many of the technical nets going as far back as September of 2006. His site is amateurradio.tv. Okay, let me drop, and I'll tell you what my plans are for the night. Okay, as always, I will ask people if they have any questions or topics or comments to make about previous questions or problems that they had, and if they address them and solve them, we'll take down their first name and their call sign, and we'll try and get to them in order of their checking in for the purposes of relating these things to us. Hopefully, that'll take us through most of the technical net. We have time. I'll share with you my latest little puzzle, and I hope you enjoy dealing with it. Then at about 10:15 or so, I will call upon Paul, WS2N, for his SpaceNet report. That will take us to approximately 11 p.m. I'll come back, tie a bow on it, wish you well, and call it a week. So that's my plan, if the repeater and my radio allow me to do so. Technical issues in the past have caused some problems, but hopefully not tonight. Want to wish everyone a happy and safe 4th of July weekend. This is our 4th of July weekend edition of the Limark Technical Net. So if anyone has any questions or comments or topics tonight, please give me your first name and your call sign.
KC2DAW, the name is Curtis, no question.
Okay, Curtis recognized. Thank you. Anyone else want to put their name on the list? Any questions you might have of a technical nature or comments about something radio-related or a resolution of a problem that you have mentioned before on the technical net?
WS2N.
Yes, Paul. Good. Yeah, you emailed that question. I look forward to it.
Okay. I just transmitted. I was wondering if I was getting through, if this repeater was okay. But apparently it is. Very good, boy.
Yeah, I hope it continues in this vein. So once again, anyone else out there with any questions or comments or topics or what have you, please. Otherwise, this is going to be a real short 4th of July edition.
U2BZ, Rich.
Rich recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight? Okay, I can only hope that as the time goes on in the TechNet, some people will arrive late or come up with an interesting question or observation. But we will start with Paul, WS2N. I assume you wanted to ask that question that you mentioned in the email you sent me.
Yes, I did. And by the way, I've been through it. Is that okay?
Most of the time, yes. It sounds like you might have an intermittent microphone problem because all of a sudden you just kind of the audio drops out and then comes right back.
Wonder. Well, let me just get the question out anyway, just in case I don't get through for some reason. I was wondering if it's possible to set up 6 meters similar to what you would use for media scatter. You know, with media scatter, you try to make contacts every 15 seconds. You know, you transmit, and then the next 15 seconds, you'll listen for a response, and you hope you catch a media. Now, this is the 4th of July, there's fireworks, and there's chemicals inside all these things that make the different colors, and a lot of them are metal-based, which means that when they're blowing up, you have, like, a temporary ionization, more or less, of the atmosphere. So, if you ever heard of anybody that ran a test, for 6 meters, or just to even hear static, put AM on, put your receiver on, tune around 50 megahertz, and see if there's any noticeable static when these things are going off in your neighborhood, or in the city, you have those five lodges. If this worked, you could point your beam at the barges. And see what see if you can make contact with somebody else, or see if it made static. Just a curiosity. I know it wouldn't be EMI, or EMP rather. But like with a nuclear blast, I don't think that would work. But you might be able to use the metal in the fireworks to hear something, or maybe transmit a signal and bounce off the fireworks. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, I mean, it was a fascinating question, and I did a whole bunch of Google searches looking for anything, and I came up with basically, I think the technical term is bupkis, which is Yiddish pretty much for nothing. My guess is it's either not documented or it failed. Meteor scatter is a fascinating subject in and of itself. It happens much, much higher in the ionosphere. It It usually occurs at the level of the ionospheric E level, where the descending particles of a meteor crumble away, and some of it produces heightened ionization in the E level, producing those very, very sporadic increased refractions and reflections, giving you meteor scatter. Fireworks is kind of too low. It's a ground level, and you're only really talking about a couple of grams of ionized metallic materials, which probably would be swamped by just about everything else in free space. So as far as I'm aware, although it is fascinating to think about, it probably isn't a thing. I guess anyone can kind of test it out, get themselves some kind of highly directional antenna, point it towards one of our many fireworks displays, and see if anything comes out on a signal meter. It's a different entity than meteor scatter. So I'm not thinking the same thing goes on there. And if it does, it's in such microwatts of power that it would be fading away long before it reached the front end of anyone's receiver.
Okay, very good. I don't have 6 meters, in the Kenwood 440, it didn't come with that. If I ever get this other radio, I'd like to get the ICOM 7300. I know that has it, so I'd be able to test something like that. But anyway, I could listen on a general receiver. Just I'll do that for last tonight during the night. But you never know. And the reason I ask, amateurs are always at the forefront of anything to do with radio or radio transmission. So if anybody would have done it or know anything about it, I'm sure the amateur community would be the go-to to find out if that was true. Anyway, back to you, Roy. Hope I'm coming through. You're doing good. So back to you. AC2GSWS2N.
Okay, Paul. Yeah, you're coming through very nicely. There was no audio dropouts, and it's amazing what 150 watts will do for you. Thankfully, I have this RM Italy amplifier, and it pumps out about 150 odd watts, and that seems to be enough for our slightly deaf Glen Oaks repeaters antenna. So it's good to know that I'm coming through well. There's a lot of articles, as I said, on meteor scatter, and a lot of amateur radio, because a lot of work's been done on meteor scatter among amateur radio operators. Fireworks, curious, interesting thing. I don't think, for the most part, the ions emit the visible light frequencies. So I'm not sure if the spectrum goes down into the radio frequency range. I'd have to you can't really look at a spectrogram, because spectrograms are usually designed for visible light and infrared light. I wonder if there's any kind of nicely published tables on microwave and lower spectrum of ionized particles. So that's another thing I have to take a look through to see if they exist. They might give you a little bit of a spark someplace in the RF range, but if it's specifically 6 meters, probably not. But you can try listening, see what happens.
WY2U with a comment.
Yes, WY2U.
Okay. Well, this is Mike, WY2U. I can offer a piece of information. It's not exactly what Paul was asking, but I did notice the other day, and I did confirm it, that there was a number of people on the block, some kids that were shooting off some salutes, some firecrackers, And some of them were quite large. I would gather they were M-80s or whatever. And every now and then I would coincide, that would coincide with the explosion, a small static pop on the radio. And this is on HF now on 14 megahertz. It wasn't much, but for a split millisecond, you could hear the pop. And for a while, it actually took the level of the signal to about an S6, S7. And again, it coincided with the flash of the cracker. So yes, there is energy that does not only get emitted at visible light, but it does seem to have a small reach out way down into the HF spectrum. Back to net, WI2U.
Okay, Mike, that's interesting. It's in your case, you're not actually talking about metallic ionized particles that give off visible light. You're talking basically about good old carbon, sulfur, and potassium nitrate. So that's curious. I wonder if there was much. Another thing I have to go look for is if there's any kind of a static discharge locally in the use of explosives. I mean, we all know about EMPs and nuclear explosions, but this is a new one on me, so I got to take a look at it. So that's interesting. Thank you very much, Mike.
Well, you know, it stands to reason. The electrochemical reaction does produce an electromagnetic field. Now, granted, most of it is up in visible light, but it's probably in the vicinity of several peak watts, if you think about it. And it's probably a Gaussian type of a signature, so some energy must eventually also be set off down at much, much lower frequencies. Much the same as the quiet sun, even though most of the light is in yellow visible, I should say most of the energy is in yellow visible light, where most of the thermal radiation is occurring. There is a element of electromagnetic energy, even from the sun when it's quiet. Now, granted, it's pretty weak, but it is measurable. And I gather the same thing can be said of an electrochemical reaction due to a firecracker or a stick of dynamite. Back to net.
Okay. I mean, it's basically a oxidation-reduction reaction. It produces heat. Heat produces black body radiation. Most of it would probably peak around the infrared, I would think, and slide down precipitously as it came closer and closer to the microwave. So, yeah, it's a possibility. I think most of the emissions from explosives would tend to be heavy in the infrared. But, you know, other things are known to happen. So that's an interesting point.
Yeah, I think I agree with you, Roy. Again, most of the energy is released as heat. It's released as heat in a quick manner, you know. So in a few milliseconds, a lot of power is released. So again, I would think that similar to what happens on the sun and stars, there is still energy down there with very low in frequency. Now it's not much, but it's enough to be measured on a very sensitive receiver. You know, that goes down into the tenths of microvolts region. And as long as the energy is close enough to the pickup antenna, I gather it is certainly possible. Okay, that is my two cents. Back to net, WY2U.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Mike. So we discussed black body radiation. That's nice. Any other comments on this before we move on to the next person? Okay, Rich, I guess you're up. W2BZ, are you there?
Yeah, the code identifier clobbered you, so I didn't know if you turned it over to me. You guys actually answered my question, which has nothing to do with ham radio in any way, shape, or form, but out here, usually 2 days before July 4th, you start hearing firecrackers going off all over the place, and then gets louder and louder and louder on July 4th, and then some left over the day after July 4th. Well, I haven't heard one firecracker go off in the last 3-4 days. And I was wondering if that was in honor or deference to what's going on in Florida. But you guys are saying you hear up islands, you hear firecrackers going off all the time. So I guess that answered my question. Back to Ned.
Okay, Rich. I mean, as far as I'm aware, there's nothing that's been publicized about not shooting off fireworks for 4th of July because of the terrible disaster in Florida. You know, people, you know, it's not really legal, as we all know, in New York. But people travel down south. They buy a couple of boxes of stuff, and depending upon their inclination, they take it out. Usually, the vast majority, we were talking about Gaussian curves, the overwhelming majority will kind of shoot them around, say, now and about 1 o'clock tonight. But there are outliers of a couple of days ago and a couple of days from now. So as far as I'm aware, there's no kind of movement to abate fireworks except common sense and the fact that it's not legal.
Okay. I wish that it was true that in deference to what was going on down there, people just didn't feel like partying too much. But I do have a ham radio question, and that is, Paul's signal is full quieting. The other gentleman is maybe 10%, 20% noise. You, Roy, are about 30% noise. And I was wondering, the way the system is set up with the three repeaters, what would be the reason for that? Because I would think if Paul is full quieting, at least somebody else would be full quieting too, but that's not the case. But I don't know how it's set up. Back to Net.
AC2GS. Well, we don't have a three-radio system right now. In about a month or two ago, the way that we got around the fact that the Glen Oaks repeater was a wee bit deaf on the edge of Brooklyn, the way we got around it was I communicated via the UHF repeater, which is not usually linked to the Glen Oaks or the Selden. For the sake of Lou was able to establish a link from that through IRLP so that I could transmit on the UHF repeater, which is farther away than the one in Glen Oaks, and then the IRLP would link it to the VHF repeater in Glen Oaks and the one in Selden. When I put in my RM Italy amplifier and boosted my signal to 150 watts, I was able to reach Glen Oaks, albeit apparently with some background noise. I don't know. This obviated the need of another link. So the UHF repeater is not linked to us anymore. So it's two radios. So it's Selden and it's Glen Oaks, and there's a single, I guess, IRLP connection an RF link between the two. If you have a full signal into Selden, you get full quieting. If you have less than a full signal, you get increasing levels of background noise. So it's possible that that Paul has a nice strong signal to Selden. Mike had either a weaker signal to Selden, or he was coming in through Glen Oaks and didn't have enough to reach its threshold of full quieting, and mine had even less of full quieting. And you're hearing it go back and forth between the Selden-Glen Oaks link. So you're listening to me on Selden, I would assume. My transmission is being received in Glen Oaks. it's being repeated over to Selden, and then you're hearing it from there. So does that explain anything?
It explains it all. Now I know the present configuration and why, you know, Paul should be total full quieting, and you got about 30% noise in the background. I understand it now, sir. Thank you very much, W2BZ.
Okay, you're very welcome, Rich. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. We're here to hopefully discuss technical questions related to amateur radio, and once we get rid of all of those questions, because I'm sure there's not that many out there, I'm being facetious, we can discuss regular science or medicine or, you know, any technical thing as best we can. But let's stick to amateur radio at first, if at all possible. So if there's anyone out there who's come up with either a question or a comment or can tell us about the resolution of a problem that they had to inform us, please give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, unfortunately, there was a lot of noise at the end. All I got was the N2.
N2 WKP. Are you copying me now?
Yes, I can.
A question for you is, what would be the best dipole I can use for maybe 20, 40, and 80 without a tuner? Is there such an animal?
Well, you probably to a degree will need some kind of a tuner because dipoles don't really have quite that broad bandwidth. But I would say something that might work with very little adjustment would be something along the ways of a fan dipole, a three-element fan dipole tuned to the three different bands you have interest in. They can be hung with the same three points that any dipole can, and they have their own built-in switching system. If you transmit on one band, it will go down one of the elements that it's resonant in and not the other two. So I'm a big fan of fan dipoles. I've used a few of them in the last 10 years, and they seem to work well. Again, they're not going to cover the entire band with an acceptable standing wave ratio. So you're still probably going to either have to use an antenna tuner or cut the fan dipoles to a subsection of the band that interests you the most. Like, if you're a CW operator, you're most likely going to want the low end of the band. If you're a phone guy, the high end of the band. But I think, like I said, a fan dipole. The other technologies as far as a dipole almost always add the definite need of a good antenna tuner. Things like doublets are principally designed for an antenna tuner. It's a non-resonant dipole that uses open wire as a transmission line that's relatively lossless, and then you do all the magic at your station with the antenna tuner. But have you considered a fan dipole?
Actually, I have. I don't know if I have enough length of property to put it up. I only have about an 80-foot stand across my front yard.
Okay, what you might want to consider, there are a few companies that make a particular design. I guess one basically just ripped off the other. Alpha Delta, and A Antenna, I think, is the other one. Make a fan dipole. It gets around the limitations of, well, you said you wanted what? What were the three bands you wanted?
I would like 20, 40, and 80.
Okay. So Alpha Delta and A Antenna also both offer a fan dipole that has a coil in it for the 40/80 element. The rationale being that it's an electronically short loaded coiled dipole. So that gets you 80 in a relatively short range. My roof is 50 feet long, and I string it to the end of my backyard, which is an additional 20 feet or so. So that's somewhat similar to your situation. The problem with that is, since it's a loaded coil, you'll have a higher Q, which means you'll have a narrower bandwidth. So you'll be restricted to a smaller portion of the band unless you have some form of antenna tuner to get you past that limitation. But I would look at the Alpha Delta or the E antenna or A antenna brand fan dipoles. I think that would fit in your geographic location. Fred, unfortunately, the last transmission was pretty much all noise. So if you go back to whatever location you were talking a minute or two ago where I heard every word you said.
Okay, what I was just really saying was thank you and the group very much for listening to my question. And I will be on the side now listening.
Okay, very good, Fred. I wish you good luck. If you decide upon an antenna, please come back and then tell us about it so that we can learn from your experience.
Affirmative. Thank you.
You're welcome, Fred. Once again, this is AC2GS. If anyone out there has any questions for the technical net tonight, please give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, let's try the puzzler. Hopefully after the puzzler, someone will come up with a question, or we'll figure out something to do. Okay. The big question for tonight is that, you know, we all know the inverse square law, that radio waves kind of attenuate with the inverse square of the distance. But there are other things that obey the inverse square law as well, and one of them is gravity. We've discussed gravity all manner of ways, as a force, as a relativistic concept of the warping of space-time, all kinds of fun stuff. In this case, let's just look upon a relatively simple concept of gravity. When you're standing there on the surface of the Earth, we'll call it 1G force of gravity is pulling on you. As you move away from the surface of the Earth, gravity becomes less and less and less, and you become inherently lighter and lighter and lighter. So my question is, when you reach the altitude of, say, the ISS, which I think is approximately 256 miles above the surface of the Earth, what percentage of normal ground gravity do you think you experience there? Again, this is the altitude of the ISS. So anyone want to hazard a guess?
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I would guess now, if you were standing, you're not in orbit, you're just standing still. Magically, the ISS is just sitting there, so that means, you know, whatever gravity you would feel, I don't know, I would say it's like 90%, you know. It's got to be quite high, because you're really not far away from the Earth, a couple hundred miles. Now, it might be different if you get out to the geosynchronous orbit, so I'm going to go with 90%.
Okay, you win the prize. Basically, the published number is 89%, but, you know, what's 1% difference? What I was hoping to kind of ensnare some people into is all the images that we see on the ISS of microgravity environments. I mean, we talk regularly of the hazards of microgravity environment, and the ISS astronauts are having all kinds of physiological problems of bone thinning, redistribution of fluids, fluid in the brain, visual problems and such. So I was hoping to trap someone in a little bit of a problem that we've all seen the astronauts kind of almost rolling around weightless in the ISS.
DDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Yeah, well, when an object is in orbit, actually it is fully responding to the gravitational field. So that full response is the orbit. So therefore, the low gravity conditions that you see on the ISS is really due to the fact that the object is in orbit. It is not standing still. It is in orbit and therefore fully responding to the gravitational field.
You're right, you are. But what it amounts to in my mind is basically it's falling. It's in free fall. Because of the nature of gravity, it's not hitting the Earth. It's missing the Earth. But it's perpetually falling towards the Earth. And it's sort of like if someone were to pick you up with a helicopter or something in an elevator, enclosure, and then drop you. Inside the elevator, you would feel weightless, even though gravity was certainly affecting you and soon terribly when you hit the ground. But the thing is that a lot of people, I think, don't really think in terms of the fact that things in orbit are just in free fall, and since they're in free fall, they have negligible gravitational forces acting on them inside that environment. Outside, it's what's keeping the ISS in orbit, but inside, it shows a sort of different picture. So frame of reference is very important.
Also, the point is that the gravitational force, I think it's big G M over R squared, where R is the distance to the center of mass of the object. So on the surface of the Earth, it's the radius of the Earth, but 250 miles up, it's not that much more. Another 250 miles added to, 4,000 or however what the radius is of the Earth. So it doesn't make a big difference.
Quite right, John. That's why basically it's approximately 90% of your regular weight. So if you weighed yourself on the surface of the Earth and say you weighed 200 pounds and then somehow elevated yourself in a stationary way to the altitude of the ISS, you would just weigh 180 pounds. Again, I think the average person who's seen all those ISS footages would tend to guess even less. I mean, the moon itself is a much lower gravitational field. The G-forces on the moon are something like 16.6% of the forces on the surface of the Earth. Okay, that was my puzzle for tonight. I'm kind of puzzled out. Once again, if anyone has any technical questions, it would be a good time to mention them. this being the Limark Technical Net. If you have any science questions in general or observations or comments, this is also a good time. So please, if you have something, hit that push-to-talk button. Give us your first name and your call sign.
Yeah, I have a general technical question about WWVB, the low-frequency station.
Okay.
I was wondering does if anybody on the net has noticed problems with their, if they have one of these clocks that receives WWVB at 60 kilohertz. I know my particular clock, I find it goes out and hunts sometimes and doesn't come back in sync until the evening. And I have listened on 60 kilohertz to WWVB, and they are extremely weak and with a lot of noise from, I think it, most of it is coming from these flat screen TVs with their various different scan rates. So I don't see how any of these clocks are able to synchronize. I was wondering if anybody else has noticed that.
Okay, John, I'll throw it out to the audience. My observations are that, and my recollection, because I've had these so-called atomic clocks for many, many years, and the front-end sensitivities have improved over the years, especially with the relatively medium-priced versions. There's always cheap Chinese versions available. They've always been problematic during the day, and even, as I recall, some of the instructions mentioned that you kind of leave them out and sometimes over some point overnight they sink. So I don't think they were ever particularly well designed for daytime synchronization, that the concept was that in the middle of the night while you're asleep, the demons out there correct for the time changes. But I'd be interested in other people. Have anyone noticed any problems with atomic clocks syncing up? Like I said, I've always assumed that nighttime was the best reception and just waited for it to work its way, its magic, at the wee hours. Yes, Ed.
Why you have GJE in there?
Yes, Ed, please.
GJE, Ed. My TV has a position where the clock is supposed to be synced up. I had to disconnect that feature. It was always way off. Their signal seems to be very weak. I used to listen to them on 10 and on to 20 megacycles just to get the time. And it seems to also be weak, over.
Okay, that's interesting. Once again, you know, when usually the only time I really notice is when Eastern Daylight Time and, you know, shifts Daylight Savings Time and Standard Time and such. I've never really noticed any problems, and it seems to sync for me. Maybe there's something in the area that's really messing up that band for you locally.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul and Wes recognized. Paul first.
Okay, hi, Wesley. The weather clock that I have, it's actually by the Weather Channel, has their logo on it, but it's a LaCrosse technology clock, and that has the atomic clock. And every year, I have to change the batteries religiously. It has a 90, 902 megacycle transmit on the outside of that property, and it transmits the signal to this thing. So I get indoor and outdoor temperatures. But the clock is atomic, and any time you change the batteries, you have to go through that. Either set it manually or wait for the signal to magically appear. In the daytime, never. The instructions, like you said, Roy, it says it's really nighttime that you're going to receive it if you're far away from Fort Collins, Colorado. So if I leave it on my desk, my ham shack, day after day, it'll never reset. But if I put it by the window adjacent to the desk, within a day or two, it'll pick up the signal. But, I've been doing this for years, so I can't give you an idea if the signal is stronger or weaker over the years. It still works. But it takes a little time, and like you said, it's a tough receive. A couple thousand miles away, it comes out of Colorado. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I would agree. It's a nighttime thing, and as far as I know, it certainly hasn't improved over time. What I find, because I had sort of the same problem, my previous version of an atomic clock that I had hanging in my kitchen. I got into the habit of, when it was time to either change the batteries or sync it up, I took it off the wall, I brought it into the living room, I put it next to the window overnight, and the next day it was nice and synced and stayed that way. So its front end was not terribly sensitive. I mean, this goes back about 5-6 years. A year or two after that point, I decided to buy the latest, greatest version, and supposedly the selling point was it had a much more sensitive front end. And thankfully, I've never had to move it from the wall in my kitchen. And my house is built in the style of the 1950s, right before plasterboard became so popular. It's the old style chicken wire and wood and plaster. So my house is kind of like a small Faraday cage. So despite the Faraday cage, with this modern technology, again, front ends of these receivers can go all over the place. So some are great and some are not so great. Wesley, you wanted to say something?
I have a science question when you're ready.
Okay, so recorded. John, I think the basic concept is that it's not the greatest method of synchronizing clocks. It's awful for most people during the daytime. It's tolerable for most people for the nighttime. So I would assume that other than in some cases where there's local hash and noise that just kind of ruins the signal entirely, I don't think it's really changed that much personally.
Well, what I noticed several years ago, just going back about 12 or 15 years, I had a receiver, the RBA-5. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's a big monstrous receiver, came off a Navy battleship. It tuned down to 15 kilohertz. It tuned 15 to 600 kilohertz. And at that time, this was before a lot of the high-definition TVs came out, I used to hear WWVB quite clearly. I could hear their 1 or 2 bit per second amplitude shift keying modulation on it. I could hear other very low-frequency stations. Now, when I tune around down there, all I hear is a lot of hash and harmonics from the various scan rates of the HDTVs. So it's really, like you say, you really can only hear it late at night, it seems like, to get through. But thanks for the other comments. I'll let the next station pick it up.
Okay, very good, John. Once again, this is AC2GS, and before we leave the field of radio and amateur radio, If anyone else has any amateur radio-related questions for tonight or comments or topics or what have you, please give me your first name and your call sign. Yes, Wesley, we will get to you. I just wanted to make sure there was, because you said it was kind of for the science segment. So I like to do the amateur radio first and the science second, but, you know, give people the opportunity, because I think for the most part the technical net is sort of meant for amateur radio tech, but I'm more than open to discuss any kind of scientific subject. Okay, nothing heard. Let's go to you, Wes, with the science question or topic.
If we look for the total mass, zero mass, if we look at the photon, we see that mono has no mass. And we may assume that it's immune to gravitation. The question for you. How gravitation affects photon?
Well, the problem is the concept of it having no mass. Probably the more accurate term is it has no rest mass. It does have something that acts like mass. They call it usually momentum mass, because if you have a particle that has momentum, and we've talked before about a photon sails, that solar radiation can push an object. In order for it to push an object, it has to have momentum. In order for it to have a momentum, m times v, you need m. So it does have something that behaves as though it was mass. Also, photons travel through space-time. And if you distort space-time, the most likely thing that's going to go on is the photon will follow that warpage in space-time, which appears to us as a gravity well affecting it. So those would be my two points for why photons are not exactly massless.
So the question is, excellent answer, absolutely excellent. So the question is gravitation affecting a photon?
Yes, that's what gravitational lensing is all about.
Now you add the word and lensing. Okay. So all objects with mass wrap space-time around them. I mean, they all do that. The most massive an object, the more pronounced the wrapping causes. When photons travel through the region near massive objects, that he causes significant wrapping, they follow curved paths because the space-time through which they are moving is curved. So I would assume that it is not gravitation. It is the curvature of the space-time. We could go to what is space-time, but let me first go further with that. While it is true that photons have no mass, it is also true that we see light bend around sources with high mass due to the gravity. This is not because the mass pulls off the photons directly, but instead because the mass wraps the time space through which the photons travel. There was an analogy with mattress. So if I recall it, it was even. Imagine that you have a bowling ball and on a mattress, and a ball is a massive object, say the sun. And a mattress represents the space-time in which it sits. Of course, the space-time is four-dimensional, but four-dimensional Yeah, but it is a bit harder to imagine that. When you place the bowling ball on the mattress, it deforms the surface. If a grid were drawn on the mattress, we would see the grid deform, so the straight lines of the boxes were no longer straight. So some of it is true for the star sitting in the space-time, although I'm not a professional in this area. The star deforms space-time around it, causing it to curve towards the star. So my analogy would say that photon is not affected by gravity, but is affected by the curved path. If we would say so. And the space-time is relativistic classical mechanics treats the time as the universal quantity measurement, which is uniform throughout the space and separate from the space. And to exit.
AC2GS. Okay, you brought up an additional complication. When I discuss the simple concept of free fall in the ISS, I kind of limited it to a very simplified version of gravity as one of the four universal forces. We've discussed a couple of weeks ago, I think it was Lou, NY2H, brought it up from a link that I put on my link page, that in relativistic terms, if you were to bring Albert Einstein back to life and ask him what gravity was, he would tell you that it's not a force. It is a false force perceived due to the warpage of space-time. So if I translate what you said, it almost sounds, it would come out like the photon doesn't curve because of gravity, it curves because of gravity. Or it doesn't curve because space-time is distorted, it curves because space-time is distorted. So what's really going on with gravity is that space-time itself is warped. And there is no primary time that's universal. There is no distance that is universal. The scary thing about relativity is that everything is relative, that clocks are going at different times in different places, that things that look to us as though they're happening simultaneously could be happening millions of years apart locally to them. And gravity locally to us is ultimately due to time dilation. The closer you are to a gravitational field, the more your object feels time slower. If it feels time slower and it's momentum, in this case it's called four momentum because it's not only velocity, but it's also time, and it's a constant. So if you decrease the time, you have to increase the other velocities. But if you're kind of stuck on a surface that's not going anyplace, it ends up that you perceive a force going in the direction where your velocity should increase. So that's what weight amounts to. But ultimately, it is the curvature of space-time, and space and time are relative. They are not constants anywhere. There's no primary frame of reference for everything. Any frame of reference is as legitimate as any other.
Yeah, I cannot fight with that. That's true. What I was thinking is that if the lines of space-time to which photon travels were not deformed by gravity, photon would go straight. The question is, what was first, egg or that what made the egg exist? Intuition.
Well, I don't know what to tell you. Anything with mass will distort space-time around it. If there is no local mass, there is no distortion of space-time, and things are perceived as going in a straight line. If you take an object with mass, it'll have a local warp of space-time, and looking Externally, you can see it bending around. From the perception of the object traveling, it's still perceiving things as a straight line. It's the same way that the orbit of ISS